So, welcome to this talk about overcoming imposter syndrome. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you what I'd love you to get out of the talk today, what my aims and objectives are, and what we're going to be covering. I'll do a little bit of an introduction so you know who I am, and then we'll run through the presentation, and I'll do a little conclusion at the end so that you know. A little reminder as to what we've covered. So with no further ado, I'm going to move you on to our next slide, which is our aims and objectives. So what I'd really love you to do is to be able to understand what this thing is, this thing called imposter syndrome. Some people call it the imposter experience, and be able to apply that concept both to yourself. Perhaps you're thinking about doing something new, whether or not you're a student, it might be something like doing an essay, or if you're a practitioner, it might be doing something new. And that's quite often when we begin to feel like an imposter, and possibly that's the reason why you've chosen to watch this training now. So, you know, really understand the concept, apply it to you. But also what I'd really love you to do is to be able to understand it so that possibly if your clients are feeling like this, that you'd be able to help them out as well. So what are we going to do? We're going to look at what imposter syndrome actually is. So, you know, one of the objectives is that you'll be able to describe imposter syndrome for yourself at the end. We're going to look at how accurate is that feeling of imposter syndrome. And then we're going to look at the sort of both the ways you can think about imposter syndrome in order to overcome it, and practical ways that you can overcome imposter syndrome as well. So that's where we're going with the talk today. And my next little slide, I'm just going to very quickly introduce myself. I won't read everything that's there. You can pause and read it if you want. But I am a BACP accredited counsellor. I qualified in 2010, and I've been running my private practice since 2012. But the thing I really focus on now is helping other therapists, especially in this area of not feeling very confident, and I help them build up their private practices, especially helping them to do things that they may find really difficult, like their marketing, because that takes quite a lot of courage and confidence. So that's my role in the counselling world. And obviously one of the things I love to do is to share from my own experience and my learning about these sorts of things that can affect us and hold us back. And that's the reason why I'm really happy to be here with Counselling Tutor today and sharing a bit about imposter syndrome. So without any further ado, let's move forward and have a look at what imposter syndrome actually is. So here we go. What is imposter syndrome? So as I've already said, some people call it imposter syndrome and other people call it the imposter experience. And it tends to be the latex. So that sounds odd. The writing from people who aren't therapists, shall we say, lay people who tend to call it imposter syndrome, whereas the sort of psychological body of literature tends to call it the imposter experience. And I'll explain why that is in a little while. But when it first was talked about, it was called a syndrome. And it was sort of back in 1985, the first piece of research was published about it. And at that time, they thought it was very, very specific, and they related it to professional women. And so they thought, as a particular researcher, thought that it was just about some professional women experience this thing called imposter syndrome. But as we've discovered over time, it's actually much more widespread than that. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. So let's have a look and see what the psychological literature says about the actual definition. So here we go. This is, you'll be able to see the full references in the reference slide that will come with your lecture delivery page. Imposter syndrome describes high achieving individuals who, despite their objective successes, fail to internalize their accomplishments and have persistent self-doubt and fear of being exposed as a fraud or an imposter. So I wonder if you get that feeling that you have that fear of people finding you out, that you don't really know everything that you claim to know, or you can't really do the job that you think you're perhaps employed for or that you're qualified for. And the thing I wanted just to point out with this particular slide is you might read this, imposter syndrome describes high achieving individuals, and you're reading this thinking, well, I'm not a high achieving individual, so this doesn't really apply to me. That's imposter syndrome in evidence. If you're here and you're watching this slideshow, you know, you're a student, you've reached a certain level in your training, you are actually already a high achieving individual. But imposter syndrome is always there telling us that we don't belong, we're not part of this group. So if you've read that and thought, oh, that's not me, that's actually a bit of a sign of the imposter syndrome. Let me just see if there's anything else I want to say. Now let's move on to the next slide. And this is from a particular book. And again, you can find the details of Young. It's Dr. Valerie Young. And she's written a book about imposter syndrome. It's sort of self-help book, really. But she says there's these five different types of imposter. The way it shows up can show up in these five different ways. So let's just run through them. So the expert. Now, as I say these, just mentally tick it off if this applies to you. So the expert will not feel satisfied when finishing a task unless they know everything about the subject. Does that apply to you? Certainly when I was a student and I was studying, I read so many books. I had so many articles. When I used to do my references at the end of the essays, I'd have 30 or 40 references. I used to work so hard to try and get enough information. And then, of course, I had far too much to say. I don't know if you can identify with that. But, you know, you spend so much time searching for information, it can actually really slow you down. And it's like you've got to do it all. And this feeds into the next bit, which is the sort of perfectionist side of us. So the perfectionist, if you're in this situation, you have a high level of anxiety, you worry that you're not good enough. And what you might do is you might set yourself really extreme goals to measure up to. And you tend to focus on the areas that need improvement rather than noticing the areas where you're really good. So that's the sort of part of being the perfectionist, and this fits into the idea of being an imposter. Now, the natural genius is someone who, if you think about your all-rounder, I've got a husband who's an all-rounder. It doesn't matter what he does, he seems to be really good at it, which is incredibly annoying because I am not an all-rounder. You know, I'm quite good at this. I'm quite happy to do this sort of stuff. But put me in front of a maths problem, there's just no way I'd be able to do it. But your natural geniuses are people who just sort of seem to find it really easy to do all sorts of things. But obviously, nobody is good at everything. And then people who are in this type of, if they're this type of person, they may find it really difficult when they can't do something because it's outside of their experience. So for this sort of person, it's actually really helpful to know that everybody struggles with something. And you may notice this perhaps work coming out in your clients possibly. And it's good to remind people that, you know, none of us perfect. We're all going to struggle with something, really. The next category is the soloist. So this is your person who, the sort of rugged individualist, somebody who does everything on their own. They prefer to work alone because underneath that seeming ability to get a lot done and do it all by themselves is this fear that if they ask for help, they're going to be exposed as a fraud. And so you may find that they're worried about asking for help because they don't want to be seen to be incompetent. And they may turn down those offers of help because They don't want to be seen to be weak. They think it says something about them. They think that it's going to show them up. And so your soloist is someone who finds it very difficult to accept offers of help. Now, I know that tends to be people could offer to help me, and I've had to work on the being able to say, yes, please, I'd love some help. You know, I don't have to be. There's often that sort of need to prove yourself to people. And for me, it's letting go. It's been a journey of letting go of that need to prove myself and acknowledging, yeah, you know, I need help, particularly with my maths. So, you know, I have someone who helps me with my bookkeeping now, because that's just such a relief to get someone to come and help me who's good at that. And then you've got your superheroes, and your superheroes are those people who you could say are real workaholics. So they get an amazing amount of work done. And when I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about some of the clients that I've seen, I've had people who've presented where they're just at that point of complete burnout, where they really cannot work any longer in their job. And they've, you know, experiencing extreme anxiety because they've reached that point of burnout. And I think this is where people can end up. You know, they spend a lot of time trying to prove themselves. And particularly if you think about it, you know, these are high achieving individuals, and probably in their work, they are also surrounded by high achieving individuals. They might start comparing themselves with other people. And that sort of necessity to compete is just there all the time. And it really develops into this sort of workaholism. And they just get to that point where they can't continue any longer, and they have such high anxiety, they, you know, literally have to take time out. And you may well find that you work with people like that. So we'll go on to the next slide now. Let me just go on to the next slide. So this particular slide, what this is about, is it's about why people might experience that sense of being an imposter. And so I'm just going to flip through, just bear with me for a moment. You can probably hear my little wheel turning in the background while I'm just checking my notes. So I think this is very, very true. New challenges. So are you facing a new challenge? Is that the reason why you've chosen to watch this video? Is it that you've got something that you're about to do? It might be, for example, if you're a student, you're about to embark on your research project. You've got to write your research proposal and you're really struggling with it. If you're in a qualified practitioner, it might be that recently you've started a new job, or perhaps you're moving out into your private practice. And so these new challenges can be the catalyst for feeling that sense of being an imposter. You might feel as though you don't deserve this new position, for example, if you've got a new job, or it may be that you worry about your ability to perform. And so feeling an imposter can come up at this particular point in time when you're about to embark on something new. And feeding into that can be what your experience was as a child and the sort of family environment that you grew up in. And some of that, there's been quite a lot of different research studies into the imposter experience. And what it's been found is that imposters can come from families that don't give a lot of emotional support. There might be a lack of parental care, the sort of warm, emotional, nurturing support. And if there's that sort of rigid, controlling parenting without that support, that nurturing support, you may find that it contributes to the imposter syndrome. So the other thing that can happen as part of your family environment is some people might have a particularly gifted sibling. And if you're not the gifted sibling, that can leave you with a sense of inferiority. And my own personal viewpoint of this is I was the youngest of four. And I was always the little one. I was never good enough. I was always trying to catch up. And I'm sure that's contributed to that sense that I get of being the imposter sometimes. So, you know, think about family environment as well, and whether or not that may be playing a part in a sense of being an imposter. Now, the next part, being from a marginalized population group. So the jury is out as to whether or not this is really true, but the possibility is there that if you perhaps belong to a marginalized population group, so some sort of ethnic minority or some sort of particular diverse population, that might contribute to that sense of being an imposter. So you can imagine, you know, thinking about, for example, we talk about the glass ceiling, don't we, and about women having to break through the glass ceiling. And I think there might be the same is true for perhaps people from ethnic minorities as well. So some of the research seems to suggest that being from a marginalized population group might contribute to the sense of the imposter experience. But the way the research has been framed, the way the questions were asked, didn't actually really encompass people from in a way that was applicable to them. And so some people have critiqued the research, have said, perhaps, you know, actually need to do a little bit more about this. But certainly I'm just raising this as a possibility that that might be a contributing factor. And that might be something that you want to consider if you're from some sort of marginalized population group. How much does that contribute perhaps to a sense of feeling that you're an imposter? And then last but not least, having depression and anxiety is very common amongst people who have imposter syndrome. So it's worth thinking about that as well. And it might be that if you are working with someone with depression and anxiety, that the imposter experience might be part of that as well. So let's just sort of think about how this might apply to you. We'll move on to the next slide for that. So do any of these sound familiar? Your career choices. Have you perhaps downgraded your career choice because you don't think you're good enough? Perhaps another aspect of this might be that you get onto the qualifications treadmill. You are always thinking that in order to be good enough to do something, you've got to train in the next level. And let me just say at this point, I do believe in the value of CPD, otherwise I wouldn't be here. And I think it's fantastic to be learning and to be following your passion. And I know very many counsellors just love to learn, and they love to learn as much as possible. And I think that's really healthy. And it's wonderful that so many people, you know, are constantly learning and renewing their knowledge bank. But I think when it can get in the way is where we get into this when, then. When I've got my master's degree, then I'll be able to do such and such. And you can get onto this treadmill, which you never get off. You're always looking for the next qualification before you do whatever it is that you've been thinking about doing. So it's worth just thinking about that. Expectations. Do you expect to do badly even when you've got a proven track record of doing well? And an example here, I'm getting better at this, but I used to get so nervous before doing these presentations because although I know that I'm okay at them, there's still that sense of imposterism coming in. Oh, I might not be able to do it. It might not be good enough. And believe me, I do spend an awful long time preparing these slides. That's where the imposter thing comes in for me. So even though I know it's good enough, I'll still spend a lot of time getting ready for it. So that's an example of how your expectations can get in the way. It's almost like you have this internal belief about yourself, and that plays itself out in the way that you behave. For example, the way I behave in, you know, spending hours preparing. The other thing you might find you do is you actually overestimate the number of mistakes you make. And we'll talk a little bit more about this in a moment when we talk about the accuracy of imposter syndrome. I'll come back to that. It might be that you're very self-critical, and so you really notice that you are making a lot of mistakes and you don't notice the stuff that you're doing really well. And the effect of that as well is that you may limit yourself, you may stop yourself from doing things. And sometimes, even when you are doing really well, you might still stop yourself because the thought of success is actually really scary. So I'm working with someone at the moment who's producing some wonderful resources for counsellors and has had a lot of interest in it. But now she's at the point where, this feels really scary because there's almost that sense of responsibility. And so, you know, because you feel a bit like an imposter, you might think to yourself, no, I won't go any further with this. I won't do any more about this. And you stop yourself just on the point of almost breaking through. And then last but not least, you might find that you adjust your behaviour to your perception of what you think other people think about you. So you may downplay who you are, for example. You may pretend, in a sense, you try and fit in more. These can be signs that you're actually experiencing that imposter syndrome. So let's just now sort of have a quick look. I'd love you to just have a stop for a moment. And what you can do here, I'll just tell you a little bit about what I expect you to do. You don't have to do it at this point. You may like to come back to it. But if you're watching this now, you may like just to pause at this moment. Get your notebook out and just answer these questions. Think about, is this true of you? Is imposter syndrome showing up in your life? And how is it showing up for you? I've given you a couple of examples of how it shows up for me. Is that similar to you? Can you recognize, did you recognize yourself in any of this? And if so, what sort of things cause you to have that sort of feeling? You know, is it that you're experiencing a new challenge? Is it that you're surrounded by people who you think are brilliant? What causes you to react? So often for me, the imposter syndrome can come up. If I go on social media, we all know the effect of, thinking about young teenage girls going on Instagram. You know, they compare themselves to others and then they think they're not good enough. Is that the sort of thing that you might get triggered into imposter syndrome by perhaps looking at your colleagues and what they're doing on social media? So just have a little think about how it might show up in your life. And I'll move on. And when you're ready, you can either do that now or do it later or write the questions down and maybe spend some time journaling on these questions in the course of the next few days. And we'll think about how accurate is imposter syndrome. Just what I'm going to do here is think about how it might show up and how we view ourselves. So let me move on to the next slide. So how do we view ourselves? And this is taken, I'm going to read out a quote to you that's taken from a book by Amy Cuddy. And again, you can refer to this in the lecture delivery page. It's got the details of the book in there. It's written by a psychologist and it's just a very easy, bit like a self-help book with a bit of psychology in it. And it really is a great read. I can thoroughly recommend it. And what Amy says is when we feel like imposters, we don't attribute our accomplishments to something internal and constant like talent or ability. Instead, we credit something beyond our control, such as luck. So what we do when we're feeling like imposters is, you know, say we got that new job. We just think, oh, that was really lucky that I got that new job. I don't know why they chose me. It must have been perhaps, you know, they didn't advertise it very well. I was just a lucky one who got to see the advert because, you know, I'm not good enough to have been chosen for it on my own merits. That's an example of how that imposter experience might come in. And what we tend to do is we exaggerate our failures and we underestimate our achievements. And the reason we're doing that is we're coming from this place where we already have a negative view of ourselves. And actually what we're trying to do is, in a funny sort of way, we're confirming our negative belief about ourselves because we believe we're not good enough. We don't believe that we could have got that job on our own merit. So therefore, we have to find another reason for that to happen. So let's just move on for a moment and think about how reliable our perception is. So as I've already said, imposters expect to do badly, even when they have a track record of doing well. And it's fascinating when you read the research that Amy quotes in her book, they put their research students into various situations. And what they find is that people tend to overestimate the amount of mistakes they make. So say you're in a counselling session, how it would apply to you is you're in a counselling session and you don't think you're doing very well. And what you tend to do is you tend to, you're critiquing your performance as you're going along, you're analysing your performance as you go along. And that's obviously taking your focus off the client. So you're simultaneously trying to listen to the client as well as critiquing your performance. And you begin to notice all the things that are going wrong. And you don't tend to notice the things that are going right. And afterwards, what you'll do is you'll remember all the things that went wrong. And if you think about it, if you think about who we are as people, you think about the way our brains are wired to notice threat. It's no wonder that we look out for the things that might be going wrong because that's a danger to us. So it's a very normal, natural human response to have. Don't get cross with yourself for being like this. You know, that's just the way our brains work. We are wired to notice threat. So, you know, for us in a counselling session, if we're doing badly, that sort of threatens who we think we are as counsellors. So we will notice that more. But the sad thing is that afterwards, we won't remember the good things and we'll go away from that interaction thinking that we've done badly. Now, another example of this is, say, people with social anxiety. And I don't know if this is true of you, but certainly before I've done a lot of work on myself, before I did that, you know, I'd go to some sort of social event and I would be watching myself at the social event and I'd be thinking about how other people were better than me. And then I'd think about the things that I was saying. And then I would go to bed and I'd wake up in the night worrying about what I'd said. And then I'd want to be on the phone the next day to somebody saying, "Oh, I'm so sorry I said that." And they would say, "Oh, I didn't really even notice." And that's how you've been sort of analysing and critiquing yourself. And this is where the spotlighting comes in, because we always feel as though the spotlight is on us and that everybody is noticing what we're doing. And that example of being at a party and saying something wrong is a typical example of spotlighting. And in the book, Amy describes this research where they put this poor bunch of students in Barry Manilow t-shirts, and then they went to a social event where they were meeting other students, and they were really self-conscious because Barry Manilow wasn't very trendy with them. And then they asked afterwards, they asked both sets of students, "Did you notice the people who were wearing the Barry Manilow t-shirts? Did you notice that they were wearing Barry Manilow t-shirts?" And of course, all the students who were wearing the Barry Manilow t-shirts thought, of course they noticed. It was excruciatingly embarrassing. And a lot of the people who were interacting with them hadn't noticed because they were too busy thinking about the impression that they were making. That's what spotlighting is about. We think that the spotlight's on us, but in actual fact, other people are actually thinking the spotlight's on them. So we're often, what we're doing is we're projecting criticism and judgment. We're projecting that onto other people and it doesn't actually exist. Now, the other thing about imposter syndrome is that it thrives on secrecy. We don't want to share that we feel like imposters because we sort of think that other people might think they're frauds, but they're not. They deserve to be where they're at. We don't deserve to be where we're at. And so we can even get to that point and we say, okay, well, you're saying you're an imposter, But that's not true, because you really aren't an imposter. You know, actually, it's me that I'm the imposter. That's what you're thinking in your head. And so we don't tend to talk about it. We don't tend to share about it. And the breakthrough for me, I've run a Facebook group called Good Enough Counselors, was realizing that actually quite a lot of us feel like this. I used to think it was just me. Then I started working with clients and realized a lot of clients felt like this as well. And then I thought, well, could possibly it be that it's more than me and the clients? And sure enough, you know, I've got a Facebook group with thousands of counselors who say they feel the same way. So, you know, you really are not alone, but imposter syndrome would love to persuade you that you are actually the only person who feels like that. But let me assure you, you really are not. And then the other thing about imposter syndrome is that the more successful you are, you know, this is with the qualifications thing as well. You know, you get to the next level, but all that does is it just puts you amongst a group of people who also on that level as well. So however much you try and improve yourself, you're always just surrounding yourself with other people who are on the same rung of the ladder. And that can make you feel just as bad, because you're just entering a new level and you're just meeting more people who are as qualified as you. And so you feel like a newbie. So even having a new achievement might just give you a new proving ground. So the fact is that, you can have a look at the Dina and Bravata study. 62 studies of 14,000 participants. They did like a meta-analysis of all the studies, and they found that the prevalence rate of imposter syndrome varied widely, anywhere between 9% to 82% of people in these studies were experiencing imposter syndrome. And what they found is that imposterism can occur in dozens of demographic groups. I'm going to read you a little bit here from Amy's book, including but not limited to teachers, accountants, physicians, physicians' assistants, nurses, engineering students, dental students, medical students, nursing students, pharmacy students, law students, doctoral students, undergraduate entrepreneurs, high school students, I've lost my place, disturbed adolescents, people new to the internet, African-Americans, Koreans, Japanese, Canadians, pre-adolescents, old people, adult children of alcoholics, adult children of high achievers, people with eating disorders, people without eating disorders, people who have recently experienced failure, people who have recently experienced success, and so on. So let's look at what Amy says about this in our next slide. If we all only knew how many of us felt like imposters, we'd have to conclude either, number one, we're all imposters and none of us know what we're doing, or, and I think this is more likely, number two, our self-assessments are way off. And I think that's a really important thing to remember, is that in a sense, what we're doing is we have a negative belief about ourselves that's informing our self-assessments. And so it's about actually changing that belief about ourselves. And that's sort of certainly something to work on with ourselves and with our clients. So let's have a think about how do we do that? How do we overcome imposter syndrome? And just at this point, what I'd like to say is that the imposter experience, imposter syndrome, isn't actually something that would be recognized as a psychological condition in terms of, you know, there's this big diagnostic and manual of mental health. It doesn't appear in there. So it's more something that's talked about than, you know, like a specific psychological condition. So the published literature, the published psychological literature, doesn't have any published research around the best interventions. But the literature that's written by coaches and people who are interested in the subject has lots of advice on how to deal with it. So moving on to the next slide, this is what Bravata et al. Says. Given the current state of the peer-reviewed literature, mental health professionals faced with patients, we'd say clients, you can tell this is American, suffering from imposter syndrome will likely use evidence-based treatment for comorbid conditions such as CBT for depression and anxiety, but there's no actual evidence base upon which to rely specifically for the imposter syndromes. Sorry, the imposter symptoms. So what I'm saying is that there's not one particular treatment that you can use for helping people with the imposter experience. My belief is that it is about helping people to have a better relationship with themselves, to look at the things that they've introjected, those negative beliefs that they have about themselves. And this is why I find that, you know, working, you know, having a group of people together where you're able to share your own feelings and where you're able to share this sense of being an imposter, which is what I do with my Facebook group. You know, it's so reassuring when other people tell you that they feel the same way as you. And it has been found that sometimes working in groups actually helps clients with this particular problem. But I think if you're working with clients, let's just sort of have a quick think about what could help. And this might help you too as well. And so what I'm going to talk about now is a concept about perpendicular power. And this is from a book by Anne Dixon. And some of you that are a bit older may recognize the name, because Anne is actually a UK therapist. I don't know if she's still practicing, but she's written a few books. And one of the books that she wrote that was really big about 20 years ago was a book on assertiveness for women. And she's then gone on and written another book, which is about difficult conversations. And I just thought this was a really helpful concept that we could use in thinking about imposter syndrome. So it's this concept of what she calls perpendicular power. And perpendicular power is this sense of almost like you're on a rung and there's people above you and people below you. And what gives us our place on the ladder are these sorts of things. Money, how much money we've got, our expertise, you know, are we perceived as somebody who's got knowledge that we can contribute? We can have power assigned to us because we're in a particular role or we have a particular responsibility. So, for example, if you're a parent, you do have some power over your children, or if you're in a role, say, as a head teacher, that gives you a certain amount of power. There's also the sense of status. You might have a particular status because you've done something in a particular, or you might be charisma. It might be something to do with you're an influencer, for example. So thinking about somebody who publishes a lot on social media, they are called influencers. So it might be that you have power ascribed to you because of that particular charisma that you've got. But in all of these things, it's power that's sort of from the outside, it's conferred to us. And what Anne goes on to say, as you'll see in this slide, is that this sort of power, it's temporary. It might be that we don't hold on to it forever. And if you think about parenting, for example, you have a certain amount of say over your children when they're little, but gradually that will change. That will change as they become teenagers. It'll certainly change once they're adults and you take more of a back seat, and you might be there as you're always going to be their parent, but it might be much more that you're just there to support and advise, for example. So personal and professional roles come to an end. Resources are finite and exhaustible. Your expertise may no longer be needed. It might be that your celebrity status changes. People grow older. So that power is temporary. And the other really sort of important thing to notice about it is it's also conferred to us. It's given to us by the nature of sort of what we're doing, what others consider important, you know, the rules of society, cultural norms. It's something that's comes from the outside, rather than being something that comes from within. It's arbitrary. It's not about us as people. You know, often you don't even choose to have that power. So This is important because in terms of thinking about the imposter syndrome, it's not about where you stand in relation to other people. And that's where the imposter experience comes in, because it's about almost measuring ourselves against other people. It's about measuring ourselves where we stand in terms of this power dynamic. And it's, if you can sort of let go of this idea of perpendicular power, you begin to move on to this place of equality. You know, somebody else might be more powerful than you, say, but that doesn't take away from your own power. They might have that power that's exerted from the outside. They might be a head teacher, but you still have your personal power. And you still have the right to be you. And it just takes away some of that sense of being an imposter. So it's sort of worth thinking about that in relation to how we are with our clients as well. And thinking about equality in terms of when we're with our clients. So to a certain extent, in terms of perpendicular power, being the therapist actually gives us some perpendicular power, doesn't it? But actually what we're trying to do in our therapy is we're actually trying to create that position of equality with the client, aren't we? We're trying to enable them to be themselves. And we're very much sort of trying to help them in that process of assuming their own power. We're trying to make them equals. And that brings me on to the next slide, which I'm taking from the work of Brené Brown, and in particular her book, The Gifts of Imperfection, which if you haven't read, I'd absolutely say, please go away and read it. It's an absolutely brilliant, such a readable book, but it puts a lot of this into relief, and it really can help you with these sorts of feelings if you're experiencing the imposter experience. So how do we move away to from that sense of power that's conferred upon us, and putting you know, in a sense, measuring ourselves by those measures that other people would use on us? What's our expertise? What's our money? What's our celebrity status? What's our role? How do we move away from that? And how do we become more sort of grounded in our own personal power? And it's about being authentic. How do we become authentic? How do we become much more authentically us? And this is where Brené is so helpful. And she talks about knowing your values. Because if you're in a situation, if you're coming from that place where you know your values, and you know what you're doing, and you know where you're coming from, that is what gives you that sense of personal power, because you are being true to yourself. So what is your focus? What are you trying to do in the situation that you're in? We could easily begin to compare ourselves with others. And when we do that, we're beginning to come out our own personal power. We're looking at other people. We're making ourselves subject to those external validation. We're trying to fit in at that point. And so what Brené says is, I try and make authenticity my number one goal when I go into a situation where I'm feeling vulnerable. If authenticity is my goal and I keep it real, I never regret it. I might get my feelings hurt, but I rarely feel shame. When acceptance or approval becomes my goal and it doesn't work out, that can trigger shame for me. I'm not good enough. If the goal is authenticity and they don't like me, I'm okay. If the goal is being liked and they don't like me, I'm in trouble. So that's the difference between your personal power and your perpendicular power. You know, we are giving our power away when we're trying to get into that sort of position of other people liking us, of trying to prove ourselves to others. Whereas if we stick with our values, so for example, you might go into a counselling session. If you're sort of like working on that personal power, what you'll be doing is you'll be coming into that counselling session. This is where you're the counsellor. You'll be coming in, you'll be thinking about how can I best help the client here? You know, I want to come in, I want to... you know, for example, for me, you know, what's really important for me about therapy is getting alongside the client, is enabling that healing to take place. So empathizing, listening really carefully. So that's where I'm coming in. So if I can come from that place when I'm in that counseling session, it's less about, you know, have I come in with this really clever intervention? Have I shown that I'm a good counselor or anything like that? It's much more about, you know, I'm here to serve. And if we can come in with that sort of viewpoint, then we rarely have that sense of shame. Whereas if it works out badly, you know, we're making it about, you know, how do people see me? Then we can begin to get into trouble. So where belonging comes into this is that if you're able to connect with your own values and what's important to you, then you tend to connect with other people who've got similar sorts of values to you. And you get that true sense of belonging. And in order to get that, you need to be real. And when you're real, you're more likely to be with people who you can belong to. So Brené says, for years, this is what she says. Now, in order to understand, sorry, I'll start again. Now, I understand that in order to feel a true sense of belonging, I need to bring the real me to the table. And that I can only do that if I'm practicing self-love. For years, I thought it was the other way around. I'll do whatever it takes to fit in. I'll feel accepted, and that will make me like myself better. But beauty begins when you love yourself as you are. Belonging comes from knowing who you are and connecting with people who get you. So I'll say that again. Belonging comes from knowing who you are and connecting with people who get you. So actually, this is the starting point, and this is the work that I think we need to do in ourselves and with our clients, is helping people connect, helping yourself connect to your true self, really knowing your values. So how do we do that? I just thought I'd slip this slide in very quickly. It's about being, isn't it? So all these things that I've listed on this slide, things that you enjoy that help you to connect with yourself. And this might be things that you might also want to encourage your clients to do. Whatever it takes for you to connect with yourself and what's important to you. Those are just a few ideas. And I'll move on to the next things. So what I'm with this particular slide, what I want to do is just run through a few sort of practical ways that you could work. So let's just want to get my notes up here. Just bear with me for a moment. So number one, focus. So what I find really helpful, especially if I'm feeling uncertain and I've got that sense of the imposter feeling, is, again, it's coming back to the values. You know, what am I doing here? What's my purpose? What really lights me up in this situation? So I focus on particularly, you know, as I say, I work with counsellors. I focus on what they need. And this is what you can focus on with your clients. If you're thinking about, for example, in marketing, in private practice, you know, what do my clients really need to hear? And sometimes, you know, that focus on the other person, that focus on your desire to be useful and helpful and to serve people can really help you get over that sense of I'm an imposter, because actually, you know, what you're trying to do is you're focusing on the other person, and that takes you out of your own mindset, your own sort of like I'm not good enough. You start thinking, well, actually, they just need this help now. And you know what? I'm the only one here, so I'll have to do it. So if we become really engaged in the process, if we really focus on the process and let go of the outcomes, we can often say, we might go into a counselling session thinking, well, I want to get the client to this point, or, you know, I want to work with clients and I want to see them. Oh, I can't think of an example, but something like, say you're working with couples, for example, you might set this expectation that working with you is going to mean that they resolve their relationship problems. Letting go of that outcome is probably a more helpful way of being, because that not only enables them to work it out for themselves, but also takes the pressure off you as to what the outcome should be, and you can engage fully in the process. Because what we tend to do is we get so sort of like looking at the outcome that we're after, we lose sight of what's happening in this moment. And it's about just sort of going into them, dealing with what comes up, and then letting go of the expectations of the way it should look like at the end. It's just let go of that, let go of how you would like it to be. Obviously you can set goals and you can work towards things, but it's almost like it might change as it goes along, and I'm not going to get so fixated on that goal that I'm not there involved in the process. Now, the other thing that can really help is this idea of reframing. And you can sort of do several different types of reframes. So if you're feeling really nervous, some people say it's helpful to see that that anxiety that you're feeling, that nerves that you're feeling, is all part of the process. In actual fact, it's a bit of excitement because you're about to do something new, and it's part of the process and it's part of learning. And that can make you feel a bit easier about it. Think, oh yeah, this is part of the process. Although I'm feeling really nervous, actually, because this is part of the excitement of doing something new. And so that helps you to feel a little bit more excited about it as well. And then the other thing that you can also think is this whole thing that those of us that have got that perfectionist side of the imposter experience, and I'm going to do some more with Counselling Tutor on perfectionism, I'll just put a little plug in for that, but is that we're very frightened about making mistakes, because we think, you know, the world's going to end if we make a mistake. But it's reframing that as well and seeing that it's not mistakes so much as learning opportunities. It's not failure, it's actually learning. And that, you know, if we do have a problem, that's just all part of the learning process. And we're exactly where we need to be at the moment. That if we're struggling with something, that struggle is going to serve us and it will teach us and we will grow as a result of it. And that's a reframe that, if you're a perfectionist, can be really, really helpful. And moving on to realism, recognize when you're setting unrealistic targets, especially those of you that are perfectionist. You know, if you're setting yourself up a really high goal, often that just leads to procrastination and you just, you can't get going because you set yourself a high goal. Try and let go of that goal. And I've certainly found, to give an example from my personal, well, my professional life, one of the things that coaches get you to do is to think about, okay, so how much income do I want to make this month? And I set an income goal for myself because I'd set that income goal for myself and it felt massive. I just thought, you know, I'm just never going to reach it. And I just couldn't do anything. It paralyzed me. I went into that sort of frozen state with the polyvagal nerve. And so what I had to do was I had to let go of that goal. And when I let go of that goal, I thought, okay, now I'm just going with my work, go on with my work. And sure enough, by the end of the month, I'd reached that income goal without thinking about it. So be careful about the targets that you're setting yourself. The other thing we tend to do as well is, say you are thinking about learning a new skill or you think you've got a skill that you need to improve, you'll look around for people and you'll find the person who is really good at that skill and you'll start berating yourself because you're not as good as they are. And what you're doing there is you're being quite unrealistic because, you know, they've taken time to develop that particular skill, or it might be that they're naturally very good at that, whereas for you, it's a skill that you've really got to work on. And why is it that we tend to compare ourselves with the best? You know, perhaps we should compare ourselves with someone who's also just starting that skill. But in actual fact, in terms of comparison, it's best if you compare yourself with yourself. So rather than looking at other people, the more realistic thing to do is actually look at yourself and think, oh, you know, I've come further. So support, that's the final thing to do. Thinking about that rugged individualist, the soloist, get support, get help if you need it. And that can be a really helpful thing to do. Ask for help, allow people to help you. People who have your back, who understand you. I've found in particular the people who know me in real life are the people who I can get my support from. And now we're just reaching the end of the presentation. So there's another slide I want to show you. And this is for you, again, another exercise, just going back to what I was saying about comparing yourself with yourself. So let's just have a little think about having a little bit of time to think to yourself about your own experience and your own progress. So what we tend to do is we tend to always have that idea that we're not enough. We're not clever enough. We're not skilled enough. We're not pretty enough. We're not old enough. We're not young enough. My thing is, I'm not techie enough. All these things, I'm not enough. So practicing gratitude is where we're actually thinking about your own skills, your own journey. So what I'd love you to do is maybe pause the replay at this point and go through and give yourself time to answer these questions. And I think in particular, as counsellors, it's really helpful if you can look at your own journey, your own life and the way you've developed. And sometimes the things that were the biggest challenges in your life are some of the things that are your greatest gifts. Because if you hadn't gone through that difficult life experience, you may well not be a counsellor or a therapist or a trainee therapist at this point. And in a sense, those things that you found so difficult actually are a tremendous gift, and they're a gift that, you know, you can use in your life. So don't disregard it. Obviously, with the imposter syndrome, what comes in is you look at this and you think, I haven't got unique life experience. I haven't got any skills or abilities. But what I'd really like to say is, actually, at this point, you as a person have a tremendous amount to give. You've got huge, huge knowledge and experience. And that's, no one can ever take that away from you, because that is who you are. I really, really like to emphasize this towards the end of the presentation, if you've got this far with me. So do take the time to work through. And particularly what I find is that a lot of the people I work with, and I don't know if I've never done a study on it, but I don't know if there's many, if this is true for many counsellors, but it certainly seems to be true of many of the people that I work with, is people might have had, like, say, difficulties at school, like dyslexia, or they might be neurodiverse. You know, looking back, it can be difficult because you think, oh, you know, I wasn't very good at school. But what I'd love you to think about is how you've developed and how, in a sense, what extras, things that those difficulties that you've had have actually helped you to develop. So, for example, my own son is dyslexic. And so as a result, you know, he never really found sort of book learning very useful. And he would just watch YouTube videos, so it's this, you know, just endlessly. And we joke about it that wherever he was, you'd just hear this softly spoken Scottish voice, because he used to watch these engineering videos the whole time. And he's so skilled in engineering, and that's sort of like a result of his dyslexia. Actually, it's how he worked around it. So you will have had many workarounds. If that's you, I'd love you to include those in this exercise. So just think about all the different things that you've done and make a list of them and put it somewhere where you can refer back to when you're feeling that you're, you know, you're struggling with that imposter experience. So you're glad to know we're reaching the end now. And this is what we've talked about. We've talked about what is imposter syndrome. So sort of had a play around with it. the idea that it's that sense of being a fraud, that you don't fit in. The accuracy, I read you that little bit from Amy Cuddy, who said perhaps it's actually time to reconsider the accuracy of whether or not we really are imposters or not. We've talked about the helping strategies, and in particular, we've talked about being true to yourself and coming back to being yourself. I'm just checking for the next slide. So think about your personal power, because that's the most important thing. That is what's going to help you. This is a self-development thing. And I would like to say at this point that I think this is work in progress, that we don't just suddenly, wouldn't it be lovely if we could just suddenly wave a magic wand and we felt completely differently? But for me, you know, I've been in therapy for very many years, definitely got better, but I still struggle with this sort of stuff. And that's okay. And I think it's a journey. And that's why it's useful with that, say, gratitude exercise, that you have that somewhere where you can turn to it. So I'm just putting a little thank you as my last slide, where you can find me. But what I'd really like to say is thank you so much for spending time with me today. And for further links and resources, please refer to the lecture delivery page below. And don't forget, most important, don't forget to claim your CPD certificate for this presentation. And thank you so much for spending your time with me. Bye for now.